Hello and welcome everyone. In today's podcast, which is episode 9, myself and Gregor are talking to Will Rowe, who is also a podcast author. But firstly, let's catch up on what we've been up to this week. So Gregor, what have you been up to this week?
So this week, work-wise, I have been busy helping doing designs, Azure designs for customers. I have updated my Docker container from Windows 2016 to Windows 2019, which took it from 12 gig down to 5.6 gig, I think it was, thanks to your good self. What else are we doing? I was studying for the AI exam, like 2 hours before it. I was supposed to be studying all week, but didn't really get a chance. And was on a podcast with Will Rowe, who was on our podcast, so that was quite good. And I also sat on Friday evening, I sat the AI 900 fundamentals exam.
And did you pass?
I did, which was nice. I'm going to give the exams a little bit of a break, I think. So yeah, no, it was good. It's a good exam, fairly straightforward. If you look at the Microsoft Learn courses and you have an idea of the individual cognitive services, if you know what they are and what they do, then you stand a good chance of passing it. So Richard, what about you? What have you been up to this week?
Well, this week, it was my second week at Intercept, so lots of learning about how they do stuff. I deployed probably just over 200 Kubernetes clusters as well, whilst working on some best practices and sort of deployment scripts and stuff like that, which was quite fun, to be honest. You know, it made it easier with the script so I could clean it up afterwards. So there was only up for like a couple of minutes at a time. So nothing major there. I've started looking at the AI 900 exam based on what you've been telling me as well. Haven't got very far with that, just the Microsoft Learn stuff. I've done about one module and that's about it. So apart from that, really, just prepping for the Festive Tech Calendar, which is going to be an awesome event starting in December. But something else, Greg, I need to ask you. How's the Xbox One X?
Oh, yeah. So a little bit of background. I used to have an Xbox One and I gave it away just so I could start studying and learning Azure long, long time ago. So now I've bought myself an Xbox and it is really, really good. I signed up for the Ultimate Pass or whatever, I'm not even sure what you call it. And there's hundreds of games. I now realise I need a faster internet because it takes hours to download games and updates. But yeah, no, really good. Playing Jedi, the Fallen Jedi or whatever it's called. So that's really good. I'm really enjoying that. So yeah, it's really good. Recommend it.
Awesome. Sounds good. So that's probably why no more exams then.
Yeah. But
yeah, well, that's enough about finding out what we've been up to. Let's go and talk to Will.
So today we are joined by Will Rowe. Will is an Associate Director at Hancock & Parsons Limited. They're a recruitment company. So welcome to the show, Will. How are you getting on today?
I'm very good, Gregor. Thank you. And thank you to you and Richard for having me on this exciting Thursday afternoon.
Nice to have you, Will. Good to have you. So, Will, let's kick things off by first finding out a little brief intro into your career.
So I'm a recruiter, and I've been working in as a recruiter for 21 years now, which is always a slightly concerning point where you sit there and realise that most of your life has been dedicated to one thing only. And so I've been working recruiting for the Microsoft technology space for about 15, 16 years. And I find people with Azure skills, modern workplace, 365, Microsoft Teams, Unified Communications, across a large number of, different areas, but mostly based within the UK. I wrote a book, which, you know, is rather well. It did well when it was free, but not a lot since. And I've just started a podcast as well, which is called Careering Out of Control, which Greg is actually going to be on. And that's focused on talking to people and kind of helping people with kind of how to move their career forwards. And that launched Monday, just gone, with Tom Arbuthnot, who's a Microsoft MVP for Teams. And yeah, so I guess I do a lot of things as well as my day job, but the day job is basically finding people in the Microsoft space and helping them to get a better job, basically.
Cool. We'll come on to your book and your podcast in our little setting. So, well, tell us how you got started in recruitment, because you've obviously been doing that a long time, but what was your kind of motivation and how did that come about?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Nobody wakes up in the morning as a child, turns to their parents and says, you know, mother, father, I have decided that I shall be a recruiter. I kind of fell into it. I did a number of dodgy sales jobs after university. I was in somebody's house selling, and don't judge me for this, double glazing at the time when I was, I think it was 18. And, sorry, early 20s. And this guy had everything. He had a DVD-ROM and a snowboard. And I was sitting there going, that sounds fantastic. What is this? You can watch videos on a disc, and he showed me, and he had all the latest toys, including a laptop, which back in 1999 was an exciting thing. And he just said, I'm a recruiter, and so we got talking about it, and it sounded quite interesting, and I, you know, took a few interviews and was lucky enough to meet a guy called Jake King, who was my first boss. And that was working for a company called Abraxas. And Jake was and still is a good friend of mine, actually. We became good friends. And, you know, through his initial sort of mentorship and what have you, he very much sort of helped me in that first couple of years find my feet. And from there, I sort of moved things forwards. But it was never, I was going to be an actor. That was going to be my thing. And it obviously that didn't work out. But I still, you know, I still enjoy being a little bit creative and doing stuff. I don't think anybody, I don't know anybody who chooses recruitment as almost like a calling, if you see what I mean. It's quite a weird industry from that perspective. So that was kind of how it was. And it was purely because at the time I was young and wasn't earning a lot of money. And I needed a job which would pay for my rent, and recruitment seemed like a realistic start. So I don't know that many people who are still in recruitment after all this time. Yes, I'm a little bit of a weird one on that front.
Yeah, 21 years in recruitment is a very long time. That's very impressive.
that's a polite way of putting it. You know, it's impressive. Yeah. It's not sad.
No, it's impressive.
Yeah,
to be in one, you know, in like one career for that long is really good. Most people burn out way before that, especially in the tech field. So that's awesome. Quick question: You mentioned you wanted to be an actor. Have you ever done any sort of like acting? You know, like this sort of background acting or anything like that?
This was back, you know, really almost pre-internet. You know, the world didn't. The only way to get into something like that at the time was to kind of know people who were in it. And I had no network of people in that at all. And the one person I did know, who my cousin had a friend who was an actor, who was fairly famous. And I sort of picked his brains over and said, you know, how did you get into it? And he had no idea. And it was totally not replicable. And so in the end, I was living in Twickenham. I just graduated. I was living in Twickenham with some mates in this big old house, and we needed the rent paid. And, you know, after spending 3 months of pretending to look for a job, I just got to a point where I was like, right, okay, I need to actually start growing up now. And my career sort of led me here because I've always had the ability to talk to people. And that was what I thought you had to do to become a salesperson and sort of badger people into buying things. I've since realised it's not quite the case all the time, but that was kind of fun.
So, you mentioned your book Evolve or Die. Tell us a little bit more about that and kind of how did the idea come about?
And thank you for the name check on that, Gregor. I'm sure both of you have read that in detail. I've been speaking to people for 3 or 4 years, really, up until the point that I decided to sort of write it, just about all the things that I ended up putting into that. And what had become apparent, and so I wrote it in 2017, what had become apparent was that there had been some fairly sort of large shifts in the way that recruitment was being done in, across the industry. You know, you're always going to have recruiters. But I think that there is the opportunity for people working in whatever sector, it could be tech, it could be whatever, for people to take more control of their own destiny when it comes to finding a job. And so the book covers 10 sort of key areas where I think the world had sort of shifted. And at the time, people just were unaware of it. And that was just around, you know, how to sell yourself. That was around how to use LinkedIn and social media to get a job. And, you know, we talk about selling ourselves all the time. And actually, it's unusual for anybody to really explain how to do that in the I guess, within the recruitment process. Mm-hmm. And that was something which I was sort of quite keen to discuss with people. And it just meant then that I could sort of condense all these ideas that I was having, and people could then listen and or read it. And you know, it's been roundly mocked by many people that I know, but at the same time, I think it's also, that's mostly for its length, by the way, not for the content. You know, mm-hmm. People, yeah. They call it a pamphlet, Gregor. But it's, you know, there's a lot in there. And also the font is very small in comparison to the page size. So, you know, that's probably why it feels a little short. But there's a lot in there, and it covers a huge number of different topics and gives advice. You know, a massive part of my job is talking to people who don't know what to do next. And so it gives some advice around that. You know, I talk to people about, you know, what should a CV look like and how does that relate to that initial question of what do you want to do? And again, I go into detail on that in the book. Yeah, I like to think it's quite fun as well, because it doesn't take itself too seriously. And, yeah. You know, I'm not someone who takes themselves too seriously at all. So
I like the fun about a career audit. That's quite cool.
Yeah. The idea that every 6 months you sit down and you figure out, okay, what am I doing and what do I want to do next, and should I still be staying in the same role? You know, am I getting all the things that I need from that?
That sounds good. And I'm guessing it's available on Amazon and stuff like that.
Yeah, it is. It's available on Amazon. On Kindle, I've made it as cheap as possible, just because during these rather up and down times, I figured, you know, people might want something to help them out, especially if they're finding themselves on furlough or in redundancy. So it's only 99 pence for Kindle. On for paperback, it's a little bit more. But yeah, I sort of made it as cheap as possible.
Awesome. So earlier you also talked about your podcast called Career and Out of Control. Could you tell us a bit about that and why you started it?
So, yeah, to Careering Out of Control, I've always had in the back of my mind for the last few years, I've had in the back of my mind this, that there are four or five things that people do or can do to move their career forwards. And it's very easy to kind of coast on, you know, in your career. And so I had this idea of talking to and interviewing people who are members of the tech community and not so prominent, but people who have kind of gone through stuff, and to try to one, talk to them to get their advice on what people can do, but also then to start linking my theories to what these people have done. So those five things are, you know, you've got to know what you want to do next. You've got to know where you're going. And that doesn't have to be like a massive, you know, 5-10 year plan. Especially given the way the world is at the moment, it's more about, okay, what do you want to do next, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of a new role or something to be moving towards. So it's figuring that out. The second is, you know, figuring out how to get there. So what's your plan? Do you have a plan? If you haven't got a plan, you've got to kind of get a plan. and sort of break things down. The third is going the extra mile. So that could be technical training. That could be, you know, getting access to projects that you might not have otherwise put yourself forwards for, but doing something to make a difference to your material state. The fourth is finding your people, finding your tribe of like-minded people. If you're interested in a specific area, there's always people doing that. And that can be anything from technology through to trains through to whatever. If that's your passion, find the people that are already there, because they'll be in a position to help you kind of move forwards. And frequently from networking in those spaces, people get to know you, and then opportunities sort of come your way just because of that, that they hear about because they're in the know. And then lastly, it's, you know, show you're working. So in my book, I was talking about the fact that, you know, the recruiting world has changed because people want to see evidence of what you can do. So that can be GitHub, that can be online portfolios if you're a developer, or, you know, lots of different things. I think back at the time I was writing that, Capgemini, when they were looking for developers, wouldn't even interview people if they didn't have a GitHub account and repo. So I think that's an important thing, and that can be through blogging, that can be through vlogging, that can be talking at user groups, that could be and meetups, that could be really anything, because it sets you apart. It makes you a more rarefied kind of candidate. And so, you know, I took these five things, and you know, someone could do one or, you know, one, whatever it is, because it will then allow that person to feel that they're more in control of their career, as opposed to kind of going, well, I don't know what to do. And it leads on to sort of different areas and opportunities for them.
Yeah, I think that'll be really good. I think that'll be helpful for you and for everyone who listens as well, because I know myself, at some point I was struggling for what to do next. So that's really cool that you're doing that. Good on you for doing that. I'm sure a lot of people will learn a lot of things that come out of that. And I like your five-step process. I think that's really good as well.
Thank you.
So I know you wanted to chat around mindset, around setting yourself a goal and trying to achieve it. Tell us a little bit about that kind of thing, and have you set yourself goals, and are you trying to achieve anything right now other than your podcast?
It's, you know what, my goals tend to be so I look at all the stupid things that I've done in my life. So I've cycled from John O'Groats to Land's End, which was just over 900 miles, did that with a mate, and then a few years later did that as part of a team. And I do ultra marathons when there isn't COVID, and sort of do, you know, 100K walks in 24 hours with a team of people, sort of raising money for charity and stuff. And when I think about all those sorts of things, it teaches you a great deal about kind of what you need to do to achieve something. And then from doing these podcasts, and I've recorded three so far, and what's really apparent is that when you look at the people that I'm talking to, they've achieved something in their career, whatever it is, but they've only ever managed to do that through setting a goal, committing to it, and then following through. And I think that's not something that's generally talked about in, you know, in terms of career, I don't think. Yeah. That often. I think that when I look at people, you know, and I've interviewed so many people, you know, as part of my job over the, you know, the last 10 years alone, we're talking, you know, thousands and thousands of people. There comes a sort of a point where you can spot in someone's career when they're just about to elevate themselves to something more. And it's because of the fact that they've done one or some of those steps. And when you sort of strip all of those steps back, it comes down to the fact that they have said, you know, they set a goal and then they're going to go through and do it. And I just think that anybody can, you know, we as the human race are phenomenal. You know, we are we're far more able and better than we think we are. It's just that frequently we're just unfocused. You know, I went from, so a couple of years ago, a friend of mine, an old school friend, died. She hadn't been very well for a long time. Unfortunately, we'd lost touch, and I didn't know what was happening. But I got a message from a friend of mine, Joe Menon, who was saying, look, you know, do you want to, we're going to be raising money for her. Do you want to get involved? And I was just like, fantastic. Yeah, you know, what are you doing? And she said she was doing an ultra marathon, which I'd never heard of at the time. And I thought she just wanted sponsorship. So I chucked in a couple of a couple of hundred quid and was just like, there you go. You know, and she came back saying, well, that's lovely. But what I was wondering is if you actually wanted to do the ultra marathon with us. So that was 100K in a 24-hour period. And I went from the couch to doing this walk in the space of about 4 months, and managed to achieve it, and kind of got bitten by the bug a little bit to do these things. But I would never have thought ever that I could do something like that, like ever. But it took having that goal and, you know, coming up with a plan of what I needed to do training wise and, you know, doing that. And I think about all the things that I've done in my life, which have been what I feel is an achievement. It never comes by accident. It always sort of comes through hard work and having an actionable plan that you can do to get there. And I truly believe that the same can be said from a career perspective, because you've kind of, you know, if you don't know where you want to go, how the hell are you ever going to get there? And if you know where you go, then you need to then come up with this plan of kind of what you need to do to get there and break it down into steps which are achievable. You know, Gregor, from talking to you, you know, you were somebody who did just that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking when you were saying that, I was thinking I was that person who didn't know what I wanted to do. And I even remember you speaking to you on the phone and you're saying, what do you want to do? And I'm like, don't know. And a lot of people don't know because they've got a job and they're kind of just, I was just kind of meandering along, just getting decent pay and the job was okay, but I wasn't really doing what I was wanting to do. So I think you're right. You definitely need to know where you're going and set goals. I just wonder, do you think once you're finished this podcast or further down the line, it sounds like to me that there might be room for another book?
Do you know what? I don't know. I think, do you know, it took up such a huge part of my life.
I was going to ask that, yeah.
Doing that. And it wasn't, and I was commuting at the time. So I literally had my little iPad mini and a wireless keyboard. I'd be bashing away on this keyboard on the train in the mornings and on the train on the way home. So I had a couple of hours a day commute and I was using that, and it still took me four months. You know, and so I don't have that commute anymore, because I work from home, and it's trying to find the time to do all these things and then fit in. You know, my son is 9, and so I do the school run 2-3 times a week, and then, you know, then there's life that goes with that. And I think it would be very interesting to look at motivation and stuff like that, but it then verges more into psychology and performance, and I don't know necessarily whether I'm the best person to
that's fine.
To be talking about that, but you know, I've never had a problem, you know, putting myself forward for things, Gregor, you know this. You know,
cool. Yeah, that going from a big commute to no commute is definitely life-changing, I find. Especially now, like, I'm working from home, so there's no commuting at all, which is awesome. You get so much more time to do family thing than, you know, be present rather than away. So that's cool. So earlier you mentioned networking as one of your like 5 things. Do you have any tips on how's the best way to network, LinkedIn or other methods?
Yeah, it used to be very straightforward. You'd turn up to you'd find a meetup or a user group near you, and you'd turn up and you just, you know, put yourself out there and chat. Which I say that's easy. That's actually one of the hardest things to do is to walk into a room full of people that you've never met and then go and introduce yourself. And as somebody who who's had to do that on many an occasion, it's actually terrifying. I think life is a little bit more complicated now. There are meetups and user groups that are all being run virtually, so you can attend and watch them and what have you. But I don't know how easy it is to actually network with people on those. But I would certainly say find yourself a meetup or user group which is in the area that you want to do more with. So Hancock and Parsons, the company I work for, co-founded the UK Azure user group down in London back sort of 9 years ago. And that's online now through Richard Conway and Andy Cross. So that's all online. So you can go and you can sort of be part of that. LinkedIn for me is still one of the main tools for kind of networking. Not in the, I guess, the traditional sense. It's more a place to sort of put your profile out and to be kind of making a little bit of a name for yourself. It's a marketing. So basically, it's a mini marketing, micro marketing platform. Find people that do what you do, connect with them. You know, you can start talking to them, messaging them. Twitter is a phenomenal place for people in the tech industry. You know, when you take out all of the issues around politics and hatred and all that kind of thing, the tech community on Twitter is very strong for the kind of areas that we work in. That's a good place to start following people. And once I think you're following people and you're seeing what their opinions are, everybody is interested in hearing your opinion, as long as it's positive and encouraging. And I don't think anybody's got much patience for negativity these days. But at the same time, if you're encouraging and, you know, you're trying to help people move forwards, then I think everybody's interested in talking to you in some way or other.
Yeah, I agree. I think it reflects on you if you're negative as well. People are not interested on things like Twitter, on the negativity.
Yeah.
I've personally found Twitter to be the best place in the Azure community. There's lots of great people on there, lots of great help. And even just for the purposes of growing a user group, it's very helpful to meet people and get speakers and talk to other user groups doing the same thing. So networking is very important. My big sister always used to tell me that. Be good at networking. It's a good skill to have.
And actually, I think people skills are really important, and they're occasionally underplayed in the tech world. But I think, you know, those soft skills are, I think, as important as the hard technical skills, because there's always now a point where you've got to interact at a business level. It's very rare that you find a back office role where you're just kind of left to it. And I think if you're not building out those personal skills, those interpersonal skills and those communication skills, I think it makes things more difficult as well. So, you know, networking can help you do that. And actually speaking, you know, I've spoken at user groups up and down the country over the last 4 or 5 years. I was due to speak at the Glasgow one in June, but unfortunately my father passed away. And, you know, for me, that has been a real life changer. You know, actually meeting, you know, getting out and meeting people and talking to people up and down the country and hearing different viewpoints that are, you know, different viewpoints, but also there's similarities across each group.
Yeah.
Has helped me become, I think, a better recruiter, because I've got more information about, you know, the world that I kind of live in.
Yeah, I'm certainly missing that kind of conversations and meeting people. I still find it difficult, though. I kind of help run the Glasgow Azure user group, and I still find it difficult to approach people that I've never met before. I'm all right speaking to people that I've maybe said hello to before, but brand new people, I really struggle.
It's like going to a party. If you don't know anybody, it's either going to go one of two ways. Either you're standing in the kitchen on your own, drinking in a lonely fashion and then leaving early, or you can actually accept that it's going to be uncomfortable for the first 5-10 minutes, but that actually if you start talking to people, who knows, you might have that opportunity. But I get exactly the same thing. If my head isn't in it, you know, I really struggle to because, and also people kind of expect from me these days that I'm going to be confident and know what I'm doing, and it's not like that all the time. And I frequently say to people who know me, you know, when it looks like I'm at my most confident, it's usually when I'm at my least, because that's when I'm sort of overcompensating. So I think it's a hard thing to do, you know, walking into a room of people and trying to become part of it. But there's also, I think there's an expectation that needs to be set that it takes time to get to know people, especially if, you know, you're meeting once a month or once a quarter or something. It takes time to get to know people, and relationships are never formed in a one-off. You've got to put the time in, and you've got to go, and you've got to get to know people and be curious and interested and ask questions, and don't be that person in the room that tries to be the know-it-all for everything, because I think that really doesn't go down well.
There's always one, isn't there?
Thank you. Yeah.
It's not you, Bill.
Thank you. I just wanted to be clear. Yes, that's good.
Do you have any tips on making your LinkedIn Twitter profile better? What's good advice for making your profile stand out more or anything like that?
That's a massive topic. to help it stand out, first things first, picture on your LinkedIn profile. So differences between LinkedIn and Twitter. LinkedIn is, I think, slightly more formal. Twitter, less formal. So I've got two different pictures. One on LinkedIn is me standing up in front of a group of people looking like I know what I'm talking about. And Twitter is me sitting in a taverna in Corfu. And it was just, I thought it was a nice photo. It's not a picture of me pulling a stupid face. So two sorts of things, but the picture is important. I think LinkedIn photos should be fairly businessy. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't, I see people who are, yeah, there was one guy who was there in a vest, and was looking at, you know, with sort of hungry eyes at the camera. And I was just like, not really going to get hired for a job.
Yeah. I remember when I was hiring for my last job, one or two people. So we had an open office, and I had to try and identify this person from their name. And obviously I looked on LinkedIn and they had like a picture of a panda, for example. So that's a good tip, because that wasn't helpful at all. If somebody had a picture of them face, then I can go, oh, there's that person over there. But yeah, even just a simple picture is quite important.
Yeah, picture's good. And I think underneath your name, you can write anything. There's like a tagline. And so if you are looking for a job, make it more descriptive. So mine says that I'm passionately placing people with Teams and 365 and Azure skills. And I'm just mentioning my podcast as well in that, just because I'm trying to get people to listen. So you can put anything in there that you want. It doesn't have to just be your job title. You could put whatever it is. So have a think about what you want to say in that. You know, if it was either of you guys, you know, it could be working in the Azure space for blah, blah, blah. But that's good. Also think about SEO for your profile. If you want to get found, keyword repetition in your LinkedIn profile of the skills that you are interested in being found for. So you need to get them in there 5 times, because the way that the search engine works is it's based on keyword relevance. So if you've got 5-6 times each of the keywords that you want to be found for, you'll rank higher than someone who is as good or better than you, who's only got it written once. And if you are looking for a job, make sure that you've got an email address or a phone number or something in the body of the LinkedIn profile so that people can just pick up the phone and call you. So often in recruitment companies, they don't have access to the LinkedIn recruiter license because the licenses cost £6,000, I think £5,000 or £6,000, which means that you could be hoping to find a job. And the person that has the job looks at you if they're a recruiter, but they've only got access to a LinkedIn basic account and they may not be able to connect with you or send you in mails or do all that kind of thing. And they might just then move on to someone else. So yeah, getting an easy way for someone to contact you, email, mobile, whatever, is also as important as getting the sort of the keyword optimization correct as well.
Good advice.
Yeah, some really good advice. So Will, I'm going to ask you about your favorite thing in the whole world, personal brand.
Yep, the personal branding, lovely.
Is it a good thing, bad thing? What's your thoughts?
I hate the term, I truly hate the term, but I think it's massively important. I think that you can get by in this life and have a perfectly good career without one, yes. But I think that for the philosophy that I try to teach people, which is around becoming more visible, you have to think about how you're perceived. And creating this online presence is really important. And that can be through vlogging, that can be through just being funny, you know, and being yourself. And I think that's a really important point, is to be, you've got to be yourself. Because otherwise people just are, they don't like fakeness. And so if you're not being yourself, people will pretty much figure it out at some point. But without it, you're the same as everybody else. Meaning that, you know, if you're applying for a job, you know, you're going to apply for a job in the same way that everybody else does. Mm, yeah. And there's nothing rarefied about you and your skill set. Whereas if you are better known for one thing, two things, whatever it is, it makes you more employable. And it means then that you might also get access to opportunities that other people won't necessarily be, they won't necessarily see. And if we come back to this idea that, you know, if you're in the community that you want to be part of, you found your people, you found your little tribe of people in a certain area, and you've got some form of recognition in that area, then people will want to hire you as part of that. I got this job, the one I'm in currently, because of the fact that they'd seen my videos on LinkedIn. The owners, Chris and Joe, had seen the videos, and they didn't hate them like everybody else did. So that's, you know, they got me, and that was an interesting thing. This was the first role that I had been offered, and I was headhunted relatively frequently. This was the first role that I'd been offered where they actually said, you know, they got what I did and they said, we want you to do more of that. And that was the reason, you know, one of the main reasons that I actually took this job was because of the fact that, you know, their values aligned with mine. And I don't believe that would have happened if I hadn't built this mini little presence and brand on LinkedIn at the time.
Yeah, just to let you know, they're not the only person that like your stuff. I always laugh at it. I think it's brilliant. So, I always watch them. I think they're great. I must admit, they're really, really good. I love what you do.
There had to be someone out there, you know, that did.
I'm that guy. So if we just circle back, just kind of coming towards the end, but as we circle back, so you cycled from John O'Groats to basically the top of Scotland, from all the way down to Land's End in England, and you've done it twice.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Did you plan that? Did that just come about to join a friend, or was that? Tell us about how that came about.
So that was all my idea. That was back when I was, oh God, I think I was 30 at the time. I'd been wanting to do something to raise money for a couple of charities. My dad at the time was working for a charity called SAFA, which helps people that have come out of the military with a variety of different things. And so I wanted to raise some money for that. Macmillan as well. Some friends had just lost one of their parents, so I wanted to raise some money for that. And I was thinking, okay, you know, if you're going to ask people to donate some cash, then you're going to have to kind of put your body on the line a little bit, because a bungee jump, you know, realistically, you're falling off a building, whereas, you know, and that's terrifying, but it's all over in about 30 seconds. Whereas this, I thought, okay, I want something that's big, but not too big. And I figured I could do this in 14 days. So it was about, on average, 60, 70 miles a day. I think the shortest was about 55 and the longest was 84 miles a day. And a friend of mine, Ray, was training with me, and I was basically muttering about how difficult it was going to be on my own and stuff. And I kind of guilted him into it. And then, yeah, you know, I planned it and we worked on the assumption that we would have specific amount of miles per day that we wanted to do. And we would sort of pre-book bed and breakfasts and stuff for the first few days. And then we'd sort of do it on the go. My wife and a good mate at the time, Mike, came and supported us for the first 4 days while we were driving through Scotland and cycling through Scotland. And they sort of left us around Loch Lomond. And then my wife came and met me down in Cornwall. So we'd cycled the length of the UK by the time that she came back again. But it was the hardest thing, one of the hardest things I think that I've ever done, because it was so grueling. It was amazing. There was a massive highs of just, you know, like when we crossed the border from Scotland into England, and you know, we spent 6 days in Scotland, you know, cycling through Glencoe, and it was just the most amazing time. And then we were into sort of into England, and we really felt that we got somewhere. And then there was the reality of, well, you've got another sort of, you know, at least a week of this. And it was like, oh my God. And then my knee stopped working after about 600 miles. I absolutely lost my shit on the side of a road, threw my bike into the middle of a bramble patch, and then sat down and burst into tears, because it was just, it wasn't bad, but it was the fact that, you know, you're constantly hurt. It was just hurting. And every time I pedaled with my right knee, with my right leg, it hurt. And so that's like 11 hours a day of just hurting yourself. And I just lost it totally. And then we managed to find a knee support and stuff. But what was the bit that really stands out is just how nice people are in the UK, because we cycled into, we were in Preston, in this pub, and it was a proper working man's pub. And I walk up in my bright flashy lycra, and I'm like, hello, we wanted some lunch. And all these hard, toughened sort of drinkers sort of turned and looked at me, and then someone sort of muttered, saying, oh, you know, you don't want to leave your bike out there or get nicked. And I was just like, well, you know, that wouldn't be a bad thing. We're all knackered. We've just come from John O'Groats. And then when they found out about what we were doing, they had a whip round in the pub. And it was all change, which was great. So it was really heavy to carry for the next 500 miles. But, you know, and little things like, you know, people just going out of their way to help us. We'd run out of water and we just knocked on someone's door and said, can you help us? And she was just like, oh my God, yeah, absolutely. You know, but it was little things. And it totally reaffirmed my belief in humanity. But it was, yeah, by the end of it, I could hardly sit down. Fittest I've ever been in my life, but, you know, I couldn't actually sit on the saddle. I was sort of coughing up saddle leather by the end of it. But yeah, it was painful, but an amazing experience.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever be doing that after that.
No, do you know, a cup of tea. I would recommend doing something like that to anybody, because, you know, again, I went from not being a cyclist of any sort and did about 1,000 miles of training over a 3-month period, and then just went and did it. You can always do more than you think you can. It's always your mind holding you back. And as long as you put in enough training to physically not collapse, you can always go further than you think you can. Like a long way, like a long, long way. So I would strongly recommend doing something that pushes people out of their comfort zone, because it is, yeah, it's definitely, I think I've learned more about myself doing stuff like that than I ever would have done not doing it.
Cool. So we've got a couple final questions that we ask everyone. So the first one is, what's your favorite place in the world that you, some people might not have heard of?
Kintyre, I think, is my favorite place in the world that people might not have heard of. So my actual favorite place in the world is Corfu. It's where we go pretty much every year. We've got friends out there and we go and it's just, for me, I go there, it feels like going home. But my parents used to live in Kintyre for about 10 years, which is on the west coast of Scotland. And at its most southern tip, you're about 12 miles from Northern Ireland. So you can look out across the sea and see Northern Ireland. It's, you know, it's sort of that far out, but people don't really know about it. And my parents used to live in this house, this little cottage on the seashore, right on the seashore. This year, because we weren't doing an international holiday, I took my wife and my son up there. My wife had been before, but my son had never been up there. And so we went back to where my parents used to live and where I'd spent, you know, summers and what have you during university and what have you. And it was just, it's the most amazing place. You can't not be stunned by the constant views. The people are lovely. I taught my family to fish for the first time there, and then of course I hardly caught a bloody thing, and they were just beating me hands down. It's the best. If you want a relaxed, off the beaten track kind of holiday, that is the place to go for me. Kintyre, the Kintyre Peninsula, and the beaches are phenomenal. You know, the people are lovely. There's a long distance walking trail now called the Kintyre Way, which is like 100 miles or so, which leads you through some of the best of all of it. So if you're a bit of a walker, there's that too. And there's loads of outdoor pursuits. I love it. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a good place. I've been there myself. So I've been down in Campbelltown and all that kind of area. It is really nice. So.
Yeah, I love it. I love it down there. We were staying in Southend this...
Oh, I know exactly. I've been there.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a farm called Penny Searach Farm, which they've got like 10 static caravans just on the beach. And so this year we just booked a caravan for a week, and it was just, I felt COVID comfortable because there was hardly anyone around and because I knew where everything was. You know, we weren't sort of doing lots and lots of touristy stuff, but it was just the perfect thing after months of lockdown to be able to just be walking up and down the beach and there was nobody there, you know. Mm-hmm. And we went swimming and I nearly froze to death. My wife actually swam through a jellyfish, which was exciting. And I didn't pee on her, guys. I didn't. Just to be clear. But yes, yeah, so that was fun. Although I was gutted, Gregor. I know you're a bit of a fisherman. There was a storm in August that hit the West Coast quite hard, and 8 miles up from us, 50,000 salmon escaped into the sea.
That's right.
And I didn't know about it, and so we were fishing for mackerel, and this guy was on the. I was on Campbelltown Pier with us at the time, and he was just, I saw a salmon, and we were like, oh yeah, scratching our beards, of course. Yes, absolutely, you did. And then we were just crossing the border into England, and it came on the radio that all these salmon had escaped, and I was like, no, we need to go back. And it was too late. Couldn't catch one. So yeah.
Last question, just before we wrap up, if you could pick someone that you know who isn't really that well known, but would be amazing to interview on a podcast, who would you choose and why?
That is a difficult question. In the tech scene or just in general?
In general. Could be the tech scene or in general. It's up to you.
See, my wife, I think I'm gonna say, and that's not a political statement. I just want to be clear. You know, just because she never listens to anything I do, so she'll never know. But she works with families. She's a liaison and between all of the different social services in a school, and she's a safeguarding lead, and she basically takes care of children. And she hears about horrors daily, but she manages it all, and me, which is an important thing. And I think that she's a far better person than I am. And actually, I think that she would be fascinating to interview to get a feeling for why she does what she does, and probably tactics for putting up with me as well. So so my wife Hannah, I think.
That's a good joke. I like that.
It's a safe one as well, because, you know, if she does hear about this, it'll sound positive.
I like it. So, Will, thanks very much for coming on today. That's all we've got time for. It's been awesome talking to you and hearing all your words of wisdom. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. I hope everyone has enjoyed today's show, and we look forward to bringing you more content soon.